You may be seated.
Quiet in the courtroom.
Tamara Felicia Brannick has come up. Mr. Powers, Mr. Murphy. Mr. Powers.
May it please the court, I'm McMillan Powers, and I am here for Tamara Brown in the appeal of her conviction for second petty larceny and trespass. Just very briefly, I do want to reserve about 4 minutes for rebuttal, so if I could do that.
Sure.
The issue here is very, very narrow, I think, in regard to the withdrawing of the guilty plea. Ms. Brown appears before the court early in February 1st, and or actually January 30th, and there's a trial in which there is a plea agreement. She agrees to plead not guilty to...
Mr. Powers, let's cut to the chase here. Isn't the issue simply whether it constitutes manifest injustice, which is what's required by the statute to withdraw the guilty plea at this point in time, when the situation is what amounts to a realization of collateral consequences to the plea, losing your job?
I think that's where we may get there in just a moment, but I think right now, at the first look at the statute says that a motion to withdraw a plea of guilty may be made only before sentence is imposed or imposition of a sentence is suspended. Semicolon. But to correct manifest injustice, the court within 21 days after the entry of a final order may set it aside and go on. I think this case is between the semicolon and but, because the motion to withdraw the plea is made after the court from the bench announces the sentence under the guilty plea, but before the final order is entered.
But isn't the purpose for the two different standards, and you would agree with me that they are very different standards,
they're different
for pretrial and post-trial, and haven't the courts stated that one of the reasons for the difference in the standards is that somebody doesn't file a motion after they're sentenced when they're unhappy with their sentence?
That's the crux of it.
Right.
And I think that's what the case law articulates as the evil they wish to avoid,
right,
by making the statute read the way it reads. However, in this situation, you have a guilty plea on January 30th, and the next day there is the motion is filed to withdraw the guilty plea, and then there's a hearing.
Well, the guilty plea was entered, but she was also immediately sentenced.
Immediately sentenced. Same hearing. It's within moments. And then the next morning, the motion to withdraw is filed, and a hearing is held on that about a week later. And then, on the 21st, the final order is entered, and she immediately notes the appeal, and we go forward from there. But what happens here is, if she is filing this motion on, let's just say on the manifest injustice, what do we have to show? We have to show, according to the case law, and the statute doesn't say what manifest injustice is, but the case law pretty much tells us that you have to have a reasonable defense. You have to show that there was an...
Well, actually, I think that refers to guilty pleas that are attempted to be withdrawn prior to finality. I think the case you need to address is our decision in Howell versus Commonwealth, which describes manifest injustice as an obvious miscarriage of justice, such as an involuntary guilty plea or a plea based on a plea agreement that has been rescinded.
This case does not fall within that. I
gather you're asserting that the manifest injustice language doesn't apply here because of your... In which case, then, you would be in the situation where you would have to present a defense and so forth.
I don't think we have to do that because I don't think the manifest injustice... Because I think that where she is in the plea is in between the two clauses. There's been a final judgment, and the court has, from the bench, said guilty and now sentenced. But the order doesn't get entered for another 22 days.
Well, I'm confused. I'm confused now because it seems to me this is a binary situation. Either she comes under the post-sentencing provisions of the statute, which require a demonstration of manifest injustice, or she does not. And if she does not, as you assert, then it seems to me the language of Paris and Bottoms and some of our other cases in the Supreme Court's cases, Paris Justice and so forth, apply where you would have to convince the trial court that you had a viable defense and so forth, and basically justify it's something other than an arbitrary decision to withdraw your plea. And so in either case, you need to address whether the collateral consequences constitute either a manifest injustice on the one hand or a reason not to require the proffer of a defense and so forth on the other hand.
I want to address the collateral consequence in just a second, but reading the statute says that to correct manifest injustice, the court within 21 days after entry of a final order. So it extends the time, and it seems to read that clause, that part of the statute, does not become effective until the 21-day period begins to run. And that has not happened here because the final order was not entered. And so our position is that she is asking for a withdrawal of her guilty plea and to go to trial on the basis of withdrawing the plea. She obviously didn't do it before she was sentenced, but the statute doesn't really provide for the unique circumstance that we have here, and that's the difficulty. Within the 21 days after the final order for manifest injustice, then I have that high burden, reasonable defense,
Well, the burden is high either way. It's higher.
It's higher.
But it sounds like you want us to buy into a notion there's a third category where the burden is even lower than it is for the other two.
I would like for the court to do that.
Well, that gives us a better reason than just your preferences.
I'm looking at the statute, and I think the statute it leaves this completely open. It's a blank slate. The court can do now something different.
I'm sorry, go ahead.
Isn't it a reasonable reading of the statute that the words within 21 days after entry of a final order go back to Rule 1:1, which then says the trial court does not have jurisdiction to do anything after 21 days.
As to whether or not this clause is just a commentary on 1:1, certainly that's a reasonable reading of it, but that would be a reasonable reading only if this court says so. What I'm proposing, what my position is, that until that final order, you're still in clause 1. You're still just having to come before the court.
Not until that final order, but
And then the 21 days begins to run. That's what the second clause begins to talk about. However, setting that aside for just a moment, once you get to the burden that would be under manifest injustice of showing a reasonable defense and an inadvised a plea, and I think Small now adds prejudice to the Commonwealth. Well, clearly that didn't occur because it happens the very next day and the Commonwealth could have gone to trial immediately, so that's not really an issue. Reasonable defense, Ms. Brown does say in the motion hearing that she had evidence to fight against the case because I was not guilty, and she does say that I have evidence to prove the merchandise was left in the store and I had my money returned to me, which is in contradiction of what the proffer from the Commonwealth was, that she was to make restitution of the $160-some. This is saying that money was actually given back to me, I have a defense, and I can put this defense on. In addition, as to whether or not it was inadvised, that really becomes an issue, and the Attorney General has spoken to that about what are the collateral consequences of conviction and whether or not they are sufficient. All the collateral consequences of a felony conviction are well known, but perhaps not well known to the public. The consequences of a criminal conviction is what she's talking about here. I did not know I would lose my job and be thrown out of my Section 8 housing.
But the law is pretty clear that collateral consequences, with the single exception that's been carved up by the United States Supreme Court regarding deportation, don't factor into a knowing, voluntary, and intelligent decision to plead guilty.
And our position would be that Padilla versus Kentucky, which says if you are unaware, you're not made aware by your counsel of these deportation implications, that's a that obviously led to the habeas there and all.
But Padilla itself says this is a very special situation.
Very special circumstance.
And normally, collateral consequences aren't considered. And so by its very holding, Padilla carves out a very narrow exception.
And that's a decision that is very, very narrow, but the reasoning behind it seems to me to be this. Here is counsel who, according to basically reading between the lines in Padilla and underlines, drops the ball and doesn't advise the defendant of a very precious right and a very precious consequence to them. This is devastating if they're going to be deported. And they're not advised of that. Here, there's nothing in the record, and we don't have it fleshed out, as to whether or not it's clear that the implication is clear that counsel did not say you will be removed from your subsidized housing if you get a criminal conviction. Should the client have known that? Should counsel have known that? How does that all work itself out? That seems to me, even though the case law says loss of employment, other losses are not so, are the collateral type of consequences that are not contemplated under this manifest injustice and inadvisability of inadvised plea. But it seems to me that that is such a devastating effect that when you do it immediately after sentence, it's not like she has now just decided, I don't like the result, I didn't like that sentence that I got, and now I'm way past time, and I just want to complain. That is not what this lady did. She does it immediately. As soon as she realizes, oh, I would never have done that yesterday, she does it. As soon as court is over, she talks to counsel, and they file the motion the very next morning.
It just seems to me that the statute makes it pretty clear that the General Assembly doesn't want people to plead guilty lightly. And, you know, and there's all kinds of good, sound judicial economy reasons why, you know, I mean, we require the courts to go through a lengthy colloquy, make sure that the plea is being entered with knowledge of what its potential consequences are that matter from a legal standpoint, what rights you're giving up, and so forth. And that was all done here. And the only reason advanced for wanting to withdraw the plea is a sudden realization of some collateral consequences with respect to her job that historically have not been anything the courts have noticed as a reason to set aside a guilty plea. And you want us to change all of that?
Yes.
Okay.
I'll reserve the rest of my time.
All right.
Thank you.
That makes it easy.
Good morning, Your Honor. It's Gene Murphy for the Commonwealth.
Good morning, Mr. Murphy.
First of all, I did not address the issue of whether or not this was pre or post sentencing, because at page 7 of the defendant's brief, he says the issue herein is the denial of a motion to withdraw a guilty plea after sentencing. And that's where we have been with this case from then.
Wouldn't that be a reasonable interpretation from the record as well?
Yeah, I was going to say, I'm looking at the transcript now, and I don't see anywhere in the transcript where there was ever raised in the trial court either.
No, Your Honor. No. Let me just make the dates a little clearer. The 30th is the plea. 2 days later, there's a motion to withdraw. 2 days later, the final order is entered. So what we have then is a situation where I think the different, if you want to look at this, when did it occur, was it pre or post sentence? The first sentence, the first paragraph, the first portion seems to be directed at saying before you plead guilty, you have to raise this motion. Then it has an exception, and with respect to that exception, it simply says when you have to make it. And it has to be, as pointed out, within in conformity with Rule 1:1. So I think you can certainly read this reasonably to say that, yes, because what we're concerned about is the light plea. That once you have been sentenced based upon that plea, you have to show more than you have to show if you do that before sentencing. And that the purpose of that is, I say, to make sure you don't have the court go through a sentencing and then have to do it over again after withdrawal of a plea and a resentencing. And I think that you can certainly read it that way. I think you may be able to read it the other way, but of course, there's one point, nobody discussed that. Nobody raised that on brief. So I don't think that issue is before the court, and I think you do need a manifest injustice. But under either standard, you have here no inadvised plea. The the petitioner knew, the defendant knew exactly what she was getting into with respect to the legal consequences. She didn't know, apparently, that the effect of this misdemeanor theft offense would affect her job, apparently, and her residence. But I've set forth a number of federal cases. If we're talking about Padilla and how it's like this case, well, it isn't, because the courts still continue to treat these as collateral, and specifically in these kinds of situations, where somebody comes back into court, in federal court, and says, I want my plea back because I didn't understand, I would lose my job. And the court said, no, that's not going to work. And that's exactly what we have here. In addition, we don't have any real defense. What we have is the defendant coming back in the court and saying, I can disprove this. She wants to disprove that she took the merchandise out of the store and says she got her money back. Well, this is completely inconsistent with the proffer from the Commonwealth, to which was no objection, and which said that she had taken it out of the store and had never paid anybody any money. And if you look at the case discussing defenses, they're looking for something more substantial than a self-serving statement from the defendant. They're looking for other evidence. You see, some of the cases, the attorney has developed something in that time period, something significant. But you have to have something there. You can't just say, don't forget, this woman, in her response to her questionnaire, when asked why, are you pleading guilty because you are guilty, said yes. And she said at the plea colloquy that all the statements within that response to that question were true. So she admits.
Mr. Murphy, let me interrupt you. My recollection is one thing, and I'm trying to scan the appendix here to see if it's correct, but maybe it's just easier to ask you. My recollection is when she filed her motion to withdraw the plea, there was a brief hearing. No one testified at that hearing.
Oh, yeah.
There was proffers of counsel, none of which involved any sort of a defense. Is that correct?
Well, no proffer from counsel.
Well,
he did produce the defendant who said she had, not under oath, but I mean, I don't think she was under oath at that point, no. Just said, I can prove that I didn't take it out of the store and that I, in fact, got my money back. Well, you know, that's it. To believe that at that point the judge was required to permit her to withdraw her plea just seems, you know, just impossible to hold. I mean, the judge has to have more than that to undo a plea together with a sentence. And I think clearly there's no manifest injustice involved here. She doesn't explain why it's unjust. She says, well, I have some evidence. But she doesn't say what that evidence is, doesn't produce anybody. Her lawyer doesn't even know what it is she's raising. He just said, well, I'll put her on, let her say what she has. And I think for that reason, there's just no basis on which to grant the plea, and the judge wasn't grant the motion to withdraw, and the judge was entirely correct in his decision.
All right.
Thank you very much.
Thank you, Ms. Murphy. Ms. Powers?
Just in response to the court's question about the defense that was being offered or proffered during the February 9, I believe, is the hearing, and I think that's on page 30 of the appendix, just for reference, as to where she starts on page 29 saying that she pled guilty. She's charged with third petty larceny, and she pleads down to second petty larceny, which of course is still a misdemeanor. And the reason that she offers for that is, I'm not a felon, and so I'm just, you know, I was agreeable with pleading down. Once again, just demonstrating that she did not fully understand what that entailed. And then she goes on to the very next page and says, what I did not understand was that I would lose my job at the school board. I've been there for years with Suffolk Schools, and also my housing. Whether or not that is the kind of manifest injustice that impresses this court and leads to a remand and an order that they should be allowed to plead again, I don't know. But I submit that that's the kind of thing that the courts really ought to be doing. the statute's clear that it's not going to allow and does not want to allow, and the court's decided cases clearly say, we will not let people come in, plead guilty knowingly, freely, voluntarily, under advice of counsel, and then get a sentence they don't like, and then come back later and say, oh, let me start over, let me get a mulligan. That's not what this case is. This is a case
of... But what this case is, though, it represents one example of collateral consequences that may occur years later. I mean, yeah, you know, you had a felony conviction way back, you know, when you were 25 years old or something, and that's going to prevent you from getting this particular job. So now you want to go back and overturn that, if you could. I mean, obviously the 21-day rule would prevent that in most cases. But, I mean, the door becomes open to, you know, anything down the road that somehow interferes with your life that as a result of bad decisions you made at an earlier point in time become grounds for trying to, you know, basically be buyer's remorse and grounds for undoing that which is causing your current problems. And the whole point of the judicial system is to, you know, have some final resolution to disputes, in this case a criminal dispute, and punish people who deserve to be punished, not punish people who don't deserve to be punished, but have a point at which it's final and over with, and we can move on to the next case.
Clearly the statute intends to do that. The decided case law intends to do that. Remanding this case for her to plead again does not denigrate that policy or that statute. It simply sets to right something that should be set to right.
Well, it becomes law where every time somebody loses their job, they can go back and set aside their guilty plea, right?
And it becomes manifest injustice. And all of those cases, I'm saying, if you have people that come back the same day virtually, that's within the plea time. But when you have the people that come back weeks later, months later, years later, they're first of all 1-1 barred. Rule 1-1 is going to bar them. And secondly, the court is going to summarily, without hearing, deny.
I know your time is up, but I want to ask you a question. So I'm going to. Okay. You are relying on Rule 1:1 as basically the life raft that gets you into the second half of the statute. Is that a fair summary?
I'm certainly glad that the 21 days.
But the 21 days
is referred to specifically in the statute itself.
So you're relying on that 21 days to get you into the second half of the statute, which makes the standard the pretrial standard as opposed to the pre-sentencing standard as opposed to the post-sentencing standard.
Yes,
right?
But I don't have to hang it all on Rule 1-1. It's right on the statute itself.
Okay, gotcha. But what I'm saying is you're relying on, you've got 21 days is what
right.
You're saying. Would you agree with the Attorney General that what you have with regard to a reasonable defense proffered is one self-serving statement from the defendant with what the defense would be?
I would just submit to the court that the defense that she's proffered on pages 29 and 30, 31 is the defense that she proffered.
Okay, thank you. Thank you.
All right, thank you. We'll go down to Greek Council and take up the last case of the day, which is Kelvin Watford versus the Commonwealth.
All rise.